I'm going to fulfill my promise now and talk about the effect that this seminar on this text had on the movement in 1976. So you may remember that I was ordained in 1976 in June, and 1 or 2 months after that, I think it was, Sangharakshita led a seminar on the text, the Ratnaguna Samchai Gata, the first two chapters. And I just want to take you back to those days, if I can. Those very exciting days when we were young, young men and women. 76 was very soon after the hippie thing that happened, and just about the time of the punk thing that happened. The Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK had come out in 76, and the hippie thing started in 67. So most of us were, I think probably all of us were kind of ex-hippies. We had fairly long hair, and we were rather scruffy, and we were idealists. It's one of the main things about the early movement, that we were all idealists. And we saw ourselves, and with Banti's encouragement, we saw ourselves as not only changing ourselves, but changing the world. That was a really big part of what we were doing. It was a big project, and we were willing to do just about anything to bring that about. And we lived in very difficult, poor conditions. Some of us lived in squats in North London, around the Buddhist centre there. We lived on very, very little. And we worked really hard, I must say. The movement had just bought this great big building in East London, which is now the LBC, and which we were calling at the time Sukhavati. Massive, great big building, derelict. It was an ex-fire station, and there had been a fire in there. And it was largely ruined. And so we went in there, this massive, great building, about 20 men, lived in that building, and proceeded to start renovating it with very little skill amongst us. I moved there from the Pundarika Buddhist Centre. I moved there. And just before I moved there, Subhuti, who was heading the project and living there, announced that we were running out of money. We didn't have enough money to finish the project. So he wanted people to start up businesses, right livelihood businesses, to make money. So I volunteered. And I started up Friends Foods, which was a whole food business. And I think we borrowed £200. And I bought myself an old van. That was great fun, buying that. I went with Subhuti to this scrapyard and bought this old van. And it promptly broke down on the way home. But bought this old van and bought some whole foods and started going to market stalls, first of all in Brick Lane, just down the road from the Buddhist Centre. Had to get up at 4:30 in the morning, load the van up, go to Brick Lane, and stood there all morning from about 6 until maybe 1 o'clock in this little yard selling Whole Foods. And there was another guy there selling Shadows records, remember the Shadows, and playing the Shadows all day. So it was a great hardship every Sunday, listening to the Shadows for hours and hours on end. And I didn't make very much money, but that was the incentive, was to make money to keep the project going. So this was how it was in those days, people living in this great big derelict building and doing it up, doing the place up around us. And we were working really hard. And Banti was really encouraging us with that, and he gave a series of lectures on the Sutra of Golden Light called Transforming Self and World. And really helping us and encouraging us in our efforts. And it was a very exciting time because Bantu was quite close to us. He wasn't a distant figure. And he would give a teaching about maybe work, and we would put that into practice. And then he'd observe us, and he would notice that we were going a bit astray or getting a bit wrong. And then he would either give a lecture or he would give a seminar and say some things in that seminar, which as soon as the seminar was over, it was disseminated. People went back to various centres and told us what Bantu had said. So it was one of the ways he communicated to us. There was this kind of a dialogue between Bantu and his disciples. He would give a teaching. We would try to put that into practice. He would notice we weren't doing it quite right. He would give another teaching and so on. It was a marvellous creative process in which we were all involved. In a way, we were helping Bantu to co-create the teachings which were suitable for us in the West as we were then. It was really wonderful. And so then there we were working away on the old fire station, and then Bantu gave this seminar on the Ratnaguna Samjagata, and before he'd even looked at the text, he gave this long teaching. And he started off with, in those days as well, there was Bantu, but there was also some other Buddhist figures who we revered and Bantu referred to quite a lot. You don't hear much about these figures these days, but in those days they were really big for us. So one of them was Edward Conza, who was a friend of Bantu's, and he was translating all of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras. So he was a really big figure for us and a big influence. And then there was, of course, Lama Anagarika Govinda, his friend from Kalimpong. And there was also Herbert V. Gunter, who also lived in Kalimpong and who Bantu had some contact with. Gunter was a very strange character. I think he was Austrian. And he was a scholar of Buddhism and a translator. And his translations were really, really creative. I'm sure Shvedapa knows all about Gunter. Some of his translations of words weren't so much translations as creative interpretations. So just to give you an example, shunyata, which usually is translated as emptiness or voidness, Gunter translated as the open dimension of being. It's not really a translation, isn't it? Because shunya literally means zero. So how does that come to be the open dimension of being? But it was tremendously exciting for us to think of shunyata as being the open dimension of being. And before the seminar actually began, Bantu was talking to the people on the seminar and saying, he was talking about prajna, because it's a prajna paramita text. So what is prajna? What does prajna really mean? And he referred to Gunter's translation of prajna. By the way, there's a really wonderful website called the Guntersaurus. The Guntersaurus. You look it up. It's got all of Gunter's Gunterisms, as they call them, the Gunterisms. So prajna, he translated as analytical, appreciative understanding, which Bantu really liked. So analytical in that there's a conceptual element, but also appreciative, that wisdom isn't just a cold looking at things, but it's actually an appreciation of life as well. And then he went on to refer to Gunter's translation of vidya. Vidya is usually another understood as wisdom, and he called it aesthetic appreciation. Yeah, vidya is aesthetic appreciation, the appreciation of beauty in a way. And Bantu went on from there to start talking about the perfection of wisdom and the Ratnaguna Samjagata in particular as being I'll tell you what I'll do. I will read you a key part of that that opening part of the seminar. We don't really have anything to do. Well, do we? Most of the time, we could just be sitting back, as it were, and enjoying the universe. That's our major occupation. That's our real work. Not to work. We need to get food to eat, clothing, a roof over our head, healthcare, a few books, transport of some kind. But the rest of our time and energy, we can just devote to the contemplation of the universe. Simply enjoying it all. This is how a bodhisattva lives anyway. We don't really have to anything to do. Well, do we? So this was said in the midst of our working really, really hard on Sukhavati. And what Bhante was saying was, take it easy. Not take it easy in the sense of work less, but don't get entrapped with utilitarian work. One of the other things he said at the beginning of that seminar is we often think of knowledge or wisdom as being in some way utilitarian. We can do something with it. And actually it's not. It's not knowledge which you can use, as it were. It's just, well, the open dimension of being. And he spoke about mandalas. And you know what a mandala is, I think. But he then went on to say, well, what really is a mandala? What is the principle of a mandala? And he quoted a Tibetan teacher saying that the principle of a mandala is really that you've got an aspect of reality and you surround it with beauty. You surround it with the things that you find beautiful. That's what a mandala really is. And then Bhante went on to say that that's what a bodhisattva really does. You've got Prajnaparamita in the heart of their life kind of thing, and then they surround it with beauty. And then he talked about the greater mandala. There's the mandala of practicalities. The practicalities of getting things done. You know, getting food to eat and cleaning your flat and renovating the old fire station and making it into Sukhavati. You've got all that to do, beings to save, all those beings in the world to save, all that has to be done. But you do it, that's the smaller mandala, and you do it within the bigger mandala of aesthetic appreciation. And therefore the bodhisattva never gets het up, they never get stressed out, they never get worried about anything, because it's all done as play. The play of the smaller mandala within the bigger mandala. So that's how Bhante began his seminar. Without even looking at the text, he started talking about that. And that's the way we need to try to understand this text. I love that. It had a huge effect on us, on the movement, because there we were working away and getting quite concerned and anxious, and we're running out of money, what are we going to do? And Bhante was just saying, relax, don't worry about it. Just work and everything will be fine. Just enjoy the universe while you're working, while you're knocking down that wall, while you're standing in the courtyard in Brick Lane listening to the shadows, selling whole food to people. Just enjoy the universe. What I couldn't understand was how that related to the text. I loved that teaching. Then I read the text and I thought, where's that in the text? I couldn't find it. And I think this is where my conversation with Pavavaja in the cafe in Sheffield that I mentioned, where he said, I think that the text is at least about as much as what it doesn't say as what it does say. And I think of the film Amadeus. Don't know how many of you have seen that film. It's rather an old film now, but it's an amazing scene, absolutely amazing, where Salieri, the composer Salieri has stolen some of Mozart's manuscripts, and he's looking at a manuscript, and it's the grand, I can't remember the word of it now, but the grand sonata, I think, or something, but it's for 13 wind instruments. It's a beautiful piece. And Salieri's looking at this piece of music, which is, you know, a stave with five lines with all these crotchets and so on. He's looking at this piece of music, and then you can hear the music coming onto the speakers. You can hear the music. Do you remember that scene? It's a remarkable scene. And Salieri's saying, it starts off with almost like an accordion. Boom, 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 boom. Something really banal. And then it develops into something absolutely beautiful. And he says he's looking at the music, and it's almost like a cage through which he sees beauty. I can't remember exact words, but absolute beauty and infinity and eternity through the five lines of the stave. It's absolutely gorgeous piece of filmmaking. And why am I telling you this now? Going back to what Papavaja said about the text, it's about what it doesn't say as much as what it does say. It's almost like through the words, you have to go through the words to the real meaning, which is, of course, beyond the words. The words are only the framework, the stave, through which you have to really appreciate what it's not saying, in a way. It's about as far as I can get to it. And so I'm just going to read you again that section that I just read you. We don't really have anything to do well, do we? Most of the time we could just be sitting back, as it were, and enjoying the universe. That's our major occupation. That's our real work, not to work. We need to get food to eat, etc., etc. But the rest of our time and energy, we can just devote to the contemplation of the universe. Simply enjoying it all. That is how a bodhisattva lives anyway. And that's what retreats are. And that's why we're here on retreat. To get away from the smaller mandala of utility and practicality, and try to enter the bigger mandala of aesthetic appreciation, or, as Banti called it, the greater mandala of uselessness. On retreat, we're being absolutely useless so that we can contemplate the universe. It gives us just a few days or weeks to stop the incessant activity of life and sit back and just enjoy the universe. That's what the retreat is really been all about. And I've been trying very hard in the last few days to try to make this text relevant to our lives, to make it in a way utilitarian so we can use it. And I'm not going to do that today. In fact, I don't really have much of a talk. The talk is a no talk today. I'm just going to sort of explore a few issues, and I don't think I've got any real resolutions to those issues or things that I want to tell you. I'm just going to explore the text a little bit in a more open kind of way and contemplate the universe through that way. So I don't really know how it's going to go, but I've given three talks which I think have been appreciated, so if this doesn't really work, 3 out of 4 is pretty good, isn't it? So I'm going to go to verse 23. A bodhisattva cannot be grasped in the past, the future, or the present. They are purified of the three times. The three times being past, future, and present. They are pure, unconstructed, and free of neurotic thinking. This is how they practice the highest perfection of wisdom. just going to refer to the 8,000 lines here, the Ashtar. Because sometimes it throws light on this text, sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes it does. The perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines is set up in a different kind of way. It's in prose rather than verse, and it's in terms of a conversation. The main protagonist being the Buddha and his disciple Subhuti, who is a very wise person. He does a lot of the talking. And then Shariputra, who asked a lot of questions. And then you might wonder why in the beginning of the chapter 2 it's headed Shakra, who is a god. You might wonder why, because Shakra doesn't appear at all in the text, but he does in the 8,009. Shakra appears, and so do the gods, various gods, as we'll find out as we go on. And at one point, Subhuti says, Buddha, Bodhisattva, perfect wisdom, all these are mere words. And what they denote is something uncreated or unconstructed. So I think this throws a little bit of light on verse 23. A bodhisattva cannot be grasped, etc., etc. They are pure, unconstructed. Yeah. So there's no real bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is simply a word, an idea. And they are free of neurotic thinking. This is Siddhartha's translation of prapancha. I'm sure many of you have heard of prapancha or papancha. Prapancha is that ability we have, a rather unfortunate ability, to overthink something. So, you know, it often happens when you've got a problem in life. Something's happening that you don't want to happen. It's making your life uncomfortable. And what you do is you end up thinking about it a lot and trying to work a way round the problem in some way. And you get really caught up with that thinking. And that's papancha. And the Buddha is known as nishpapancha. No papancha. The Buddha does not papanchize. And we can get really caught up in that kind of thinking. I remember in one of the songs of Milarepa, Milarepa's talking to his very talented but rather wayward disciple Rechungpa, and he says, stop thinking so much and practice. Yeah, stop thinking so much and practice. So papancha is a kind of very uncreative thinking, and it's based on the idea that I have a self, and there's pleasant and there's unpleasant, and I want to avoid the unpleasant and get as much as the pleasant as I can. That's basically what papancha goes round and round about. So the bodhisattva is free of papancha. This is how they practice the highest perfection of wisdom. Now verses 24 and 25 go together. 24 is what a bodhisattva does do, and 25 is what a bodhisattva doesn't. So, 24. When a bodhisattva who has understanding practices in this way, reflecting on non-arising, they develop great compassion without forming any notion of a living being. This is how they practice the highest perfection of wisdom. 25. If a notion of suffering and a notion of living beings arise in them, they then think, I will work to end suffering for the welfare of the world. A bodhisattva who mistakenly imagines an essential self and living beings in this way is not practicing the highest perfection of wisdom. So in verse 24, basically what he says is, bodhisattvas, they develop compassion for all living beings, but they have no notion of separate living beings. And in 24, this is what the bodhisattva doesn't do. They don't think, I will work to end suffering for the welfare of the world. They don't think that. They also don't think the first line, if a notion of suffering and a notion of living beings arises in them. So the The operative word is notion. A notion of suffering and a notion of living beings arises in them. This is samnya, which is often translated as perception. A perception of a living being or a perception of suffering. But it's more than perception. It's you could say identification. Samnya is when you perceive something, let's say with the eye, but you also give it a label. You identify it. Oh, that's a red blanket. Yeah, that's what you do. So, verse 27 helps us with this. In a way, verse 27 is the part of the whole thing. It's the, everything can be understood through verse 27. All words from phenomena in the world must be left behind. So now I'm going to refer to the 8,000 lines. Shariputra's getting really confused at this point. Because, you know, Subhuti's been talking about bodhisattvas, but there aren't really any bodhisattvas. There are no things that arise. Bodhisattvas don't arise, etc., etc. And he just can't get it. So he says, Shariputra, but if a bodhisattva is non-arising, how then does he go on the difficult pilgrimage? The difficult pilgrimage is innumerous lifetimes saving living beings. And how can he possibly endure the experience of those sufferings on that difficult pilgrimage for the sake of beings? Subhuti answers, I do not look for a bodhisattva who goes on the difficult pilgrimage. In any case, one who courses is Konza's translation of chari, so we could say lives or practices. In any case, one who courses in the perception of difficulties is not a bodhisattva. Because one who has generated a perception of difficulties is unable to work the welfare of countless beings. On the contrary, he forms the notion of ease. He forms the notion that all beings, whether men or women, are his parents and children. And thus, he goes on the pilgrimage of a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva should therefore identify all beings with his parents and children. Yes, even with his own self, like this. As I myself want to be quite free from all sufferings, just so all beings want to be quite free from all sufferings. In addition, with regard to all beings, one should form the notion, I ought not to desert all these beings. I ought to set them free from the quite measureless heap of sufferings. And I should not produce towards them a thought of hate, even though I might be dismembered 100 times. It is thus that a bodhisattva should lift up his heart. So on the one hand, he's saying, one who courses in the perception of difficulties is not a bodhisattva. And on the other hand, he's saying, just as I myself want to be quite free from all sufferings, just so all beings want to be quite free from sufferings, and I will try to free them from their sufferings. So, what can we make of this? I'm going to sort of wind into it from my own experience. as a teacher, really, and a trainer of teachers. So for many years, I was the director of training of Breathworks, and I taught Breathworks courses, a lot of courses for people who were in pain, physical pain, with long-term illnesses, which included long-term physical pain. And so they used to come to an 8-week course, and I used to teach them mindfulness and metta-bhavana and mindfulness of breathing as a way to work with their pain. So in a way, you could say it was bodhisattva activity. And what became very obvious to me very early on was what I could see was, after a few weeks, on the first week, they came, they were sitting in a circle round me, and they were really tired. You could see they were absolutely knackered. Their faces were drawn with tiredness because, you know, the pain was really tiring. It kept them awake at night often, but also, you know, just pain is very, very tiring. So they were really tired and drawn, and the life had gone out of their eyes. And they look quite depressed, and they were often depressed because it's a very hard thing to live with pain. There's no end to it in this life. And that's what they had to live with. And often they used to come to the classes absolutely at the end of their tether. They tried everything. You know, they'd been to the doctor numerous times. The doctor had sent them on to see various specialists. And, of course, in the Western medicine, we get the idea that everything can be fixed, everything can be cured, but that's very, very far from the case. And then doctors don't know what to do when they can't cure someone. They say, I can't do any more for you, I'm sorry. You just have to learn to live with it. And then the question arises, well, how do I live with it? How do I live with this terrible pain that I'm living with all day and all night? How do you live with that? So there they were. They were sitting in the class with me, and they wanted an answer. And we just taught them how to do the mindfulness of breathing and how to be mindful in the daytime. And we taught them about the two arrows, primary suffering and secondary suffering, the first arrow and the second arrow. And you just have to live with the primary suffering, which is the pain, but not papanchize over it, not get into papancha and make it worse by your thoughts and your reactions to it and so on. And after maybe 3 or 4 weeks, what would happen is someone would come to the class, and I would see a difference. I could just see it immediately. Their eyes were brighter, and their face was better. It was more shining than it was, and even their complexion was different. And I would say, as they came into the room, "Oh, you look different." And they'd go, "Yeah." And it was magic, absolutely magic. And that would be contagious. People would catch that, and then the next week a few more people, and by the end of the course, probably nearly everyone had become a different person. They, as we used to say, changed their relationship to their condition or their suffering. The suffering was still there. The pain was still there, but they changed their whole relationship to it. And when you change your relationship to your suffering, basically that entails you change your relationship to the whole of life. You change everything. So it was a massive, big change for people. Really, really rewarding to see. And so then when I was training people how to do this work, you have to teach them, you know, how to do it, how to talk to people, and how to teach very, very clearly so people get it. But then I used to say to them, you know what the most important thing is as a teacher when you're doing this work? And they didn't know, or they guessed, they were trying to guess, you know, is it this, is it this? I said, no. The most important thing is that you love your students. You love them. Just love them. And they were really shocked, you know, because nowadays in the age of safety and all that, she's like, you can't love your students. No, you just love them for the whole time that they're there, just for that 2.5 hours. And they would think that's a really tall order, but it actually is not. It's a really easy thing to do for 2.5 hours. And by love them, I don't mean, as you know from my talk a couple of days ago, I don't mean that you feel this great glow of warmth in your heart. I never did. That's not what I mean by love someone. I mean, just for that 2.5 hours, you put them first. They are the most important people in your life at the moment, just for those 2.5 hours. So everything is for them. So as a Breathworks teacher, all you do for 2.5 hours, you look after those people, you give them what they need. And so you do a body scan, and a lot of them can't get onto the floor on their own. So you help them get onto the floor. And there they're on the floor on these kind of mats, and it's not very comfy. So you have to try and make them as comfy as you can be. What do you need? You need another cushion on your head. You go and get the cushion. They don't get up to get the cushion. You get the cushion. Do you need a blanket? You put a bit, and you make sure they're comfortable. And then it's tea break. You go down and make the tea. They don't make the tea. You make the tea for them. They just come down and sit down, and you make them tea, and you get them exactly what they need. And then right, just for 2.5 hours. And then they go. And then that's it. That's the end of that until another week. So I say, it's only for 2.5 hours, over 8 weeks. You can do that. And it's not hard. It isn't, really isn't hard. When you see them, you'll realise that it's dead easy to look after those people. And it does you so much good. For 2.5 hours, you forget all about yourself. You're just not important. Your troubles are as nothing compared to those people. So it's a really easy thing to do, and it makes you happier because you forget yourself. There's a wonderful kind of self-forgetting that happens. So this is what I say when I'm teaching order members how to teach now. I say exactly the same thing, because the same thing applies. The most important thing you do as a teacher is that you love your students. Just for the time of that class, you love them. And you give them what they need, which is the Dharma. And you don't fall out with them. You don't get into an argument with them. You don't stand on what you think. You just give them what they need. And whether they take it or not is up to them. It's not up to you. It's up to them. You give them what you need. And it's an easy thing to do. It's not hard work. It's easy. And it makes you happy. So what I often say is, teaching the Dharma is a wonderful thing to do, and do it as much as you can, because when you're teaching the Dharma, if you're teaching it as you should teach it, you forget all about yourself, which is wonderful. There's this wonderful self-forgetting, and that puts you in a really good state, that kalachitta that I spoke about on the first day. The best way to get your students into the kalachitta is to be in it yourself. And honestly, nearly every time I teach, I slip into the kalachitta. I slip into this concentrated, inspired state of mind, happy state of mind. And then, what am I talking about? I'm talking about the Dharma. So I'm reflecting on the Dharma in this happy state of mind. What could be better than that? And a couple of teachers order members on my teacher training last week, I was really, really gratified when they reported out at the end that I realise now that when I'm teaching the Dharma, I'm in the first dhyana. So this is a really great thing for people to realise, because lots of us find we really hard to get into the first dhyana when we're sitting in meditation, but it's not a hard state to get into, actually. And you'll find this if you start teaching the Dharma, that it's actually really easy to get into when you're teaching the Dharma. So, what's all this got to do with the text? Well, I think it's got a lot to do with the text, because I think what the text is saying is, don't think of the Bodhisattva ideal as being this big, heavy burden that you're carrying, that it's going to be really, really difficult, and it's going to be lifetimes ahead of you suffering, 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 helping living beings. It's not like that. The Bodhisattva life is a really happy life. It's a life of happiness and ease. Teaching the Dharma is a joy, an absolute joy. And not every order member wants to teach. But if you're doing something for the centre, the volunteers who come and clean the centre every week at the Manchester Buddhist Centre, they don't seem like they're carrying a heavy burden to me. They seem really happy. There's a lot of laughter and joy coming from the volunteers. And when you're building a new centre, when you go to a new town somewhere, a new city, maybe in another country, and you start setting up activities, what can happen is it becomes a burden for the order members and they start falling out with each other and it all goes wrong. And that's a great shame, because if only they could have just let go of the worry and the feeling of burdensomeness of it, it had been so much better. And sometimes you see order members running centres and they're working really hard, and they're working too hard, and their attitude towards their work is probably not quite right, and they start getting really run down by it and start to get resentful, because the bigger the centre you've got, the less percentage of order members around the place work at the centre. So when you've got a centre with 5 order members, probably all 5 order members are at the centre working. When you've got a city with 50 order members, probably only 10 order members are actually working at the centre. And they start to feel burdened, and it's all too much for them, and they start resenting those order members who aren't helping. And that really doesn't help at all. So the best way to practice the Dharma is do it in a state of joy and happiness and lightness and fun and play. That's really the best way to do it. And if you can do that, that's really attractive, and then other people will want to join you in that. Nibbaya last week, he gave a talk, and he said FOMO. He used this word FOMO, and nobody knew what FOMO is: fear of missing out. And what you need to do at a centre is make it so enjoyable that people have this fear of missing out on it. They want to come and get involved with that. So this is really what the Bodhisattva's life is. So, coming back to the text, you've got, when a Bodhisattva who has understanding practices in this way, reflecting on non-arising, they develop great compassion without forming any notion of a living being. This is how they practice the highest perfection of wisdom. It all just happens really spontaneously. And this is why I think Sangha is so important. The practice of Sangha is because when you're involved in the movement, when you're involved in the order in the movement, there's always lots and lots of things to be done at your local centre. You know, the centre team are always asking for volunteers. You know, can you help us? Can you help us? And if you help, it should be done in the spirit of generosity and lightness and happiness, not as if, oh, all right, I'll come and help you. That doesn't really help anybody. So when you're helping, what's happening there is you're giving up your time, your energy, but not in a sacrificial kind of way, more in a sense of it's really good for you to do that, because it overcomes your sense of separate selfhood, which is the burden. The burden is separate selfhood. And when you start helping out with the Sangha, you just let go of that burden. You let go of the notion of a separate selfhood, and you begin to flow with everybody else's energy. And that's why Sangha is such a brilliant thing. It's such a happy, joyful thing to be involved in the Sangha. And you start helping out, and you start, like, I do things for volunteers occasionally at the centre. You know, I do a study session for them. And the first time I did that, there's this woman, Bridie, an Irish woman. She comes every Tuesday to... And I said, I'd like to do something for you. I said, no, I don't need you to do anything for me, because doing something at the centre, I don't find it a burden. I love doing that. I don't need anything back. I don't need you to give me anything back, because giving at the centre is me actually receiving. So that's the way a Bodhisattva lives. Yes, there's a few more things I was going to say, but there's no time to say them now. I want to end with something really quite mysterious. And it's in chapter 2. I'm sorry we haven't had more time to go into chapter 2, because it's a very interesting chapter. But I just want to look at verses 9 and 10. Verse 9 goes, form is not wisdom, and wisdom is not found in form. Consciousness, perception, sensation, and volition are not wisdom, and wisdom is not found in them. It is like space, ungraspable. So wisdom is like space, ungraspable. Number 10, the nature of all foundations is boundless. The nature of all beings is boundless. The nature of space is boundless. So too, the nature of the wisdom of the knowers of the world is boundless. Last year or the year before, I was doing a solitary retreat at home and I was reading out The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, reading out loud. And I came across the corresponding passage, which is quite a bit longer. And it really fascinated me. I can't find it now. Oh yeah. Really fascinated me. What fascinated me was the idea that I could get that wisdom was boundless. What I couldn't really understand was how objects are boundless. And then how beings are boundless. How is a being boundless? It really fascinated me. And I'll just read you a bit from here. Chakra says to Subhuti, "How is it, holy Subhuti, that perfect wisdom is an infinite perfection by reason of the infinitude or boundlessness of beings?" Subhuti says, "It is not so because of their exceedingly great number and abundance." So that makes it clear that when the text talks about the boundlessness of beings, it doesn't mean the fact that there are very many of them. Yeah. So in other words, each being in him or herself is boundless in some way. Chakra then says, "How then, holy Subhuti, is perfect wisdom an infinite perfection by reason of the infinitude, the boundlessness of beings?" He answers in a way that you would expect. He's just talking about being. It's just a word, a label, doesn't really apply to reality kind of thing. But that didn't really satisfy me. And I thought quite a lot about it. I didn't come to any particular conclusions, but I'm just going to share something with you now. On the first day, at the end of my first talk, I talked about no self and how it doesn't really mean that you don't exist. It means that you're dependent. You don't exist alone in isolation. You exist in dependence upon oxygen, gravity, temperature, water, etc., etc. And then beings in society, we all depend on each other for our well-being. You could say I depended on my parents for my well-being, and then my teachers for my education, and so on. So that's what I think no self really means. So then I began to think, well, is boundlessness something like that? Is boundlessness really showing selflessness in the sense that there are no isolated selves? That must be what it's getting at somehow. And in the fact that there's no another, Richard Jones translates it, beings have no boundaries. There are no boundaries now in living beings. So you could understand it like that. So that's one way of understanding it, but I can't help thinking there's something else. There's another meaning. There's a deeper meaning somehow about beings are boundless, which I haven't quite got, and perhaps I'll never get. Maybe it's a kind of mystery that can never be fully understood. Last November, I was at another teaching event, teacher training event, at the LBC, and the chairman of the Stockholm Buddhist Centre was there, Prasada Charan. And He read a poem by the Swedish poet Thomas Tranströmer. And it was his own translation. I'm going to read it to you. It's called Roman Arches. Inside the mighty Roman church, the tourists stood crowded in the half dark. Arch extended behind arch, and no overview. A few candle flames flickered. An angel without a face embraced me and whispered through the entire body, "Do not be ashamed because you are human. Be proud. Inside you, arch behind arch opens infinitely. You will never be completed, and it is as it should be. I was blinded by tears and led out into the sun-gazing piazza, together with Mr. and Mrs. Jones, Mr. Tanaka and Signora Sabatini. And inside them all, arch behind arch opened infinitely." That doesn't really give us an answer, but in a way it extends the mystery, I think, that in some sense, deep within us, we are infinite, boundless. And if you remember how I finished the talk the other day, either yesterday or the day before, the Buddha is deep, boundless, like the ocean. And I'm going to finish with one last piece of the text. I'm going back to, if I'll be able to find it now. I've lost my page. No, here we are. I'm going back to the time of 1976 again. The time of Sangharakshita and Lama Govinda and Edward Konza and Herbert Gunter. And the readings we read in pujas were largely drawn from those figures. And there was a reading that I absolutely loved that I used to read whenever I could in a puja, and I loved it when someone else read it, and I haven't heard it for many, many years. And I want to read it to you to finish. Subhuti had been saying something pretty incomprehensible. Thereupon the gods thought, "May the holy Subhuti..." No. Thereupon the thought came to some of the gods in that assembly, "What the fairies talk and murmur, that we understand, though mumbled. What Subhuti has just told us, that we do not understand." Subhuti read their thoughts and said, "There is nothing to understand, nothing at all to understand, for nothing in particular has been indicated, nothing in particular has been explained." Thereupon the gods thought, "May the holy Subhuti enlarge on this. May the holy Subhuti enlarge on this. What the holy Subhuti here explores, demonstrates and teaches, that is remoter than the remote, subtler than the subtle, deeper than the deep." Subhuti read their thoughts and said, "No one can attain any of the fruits of the holy life or keep it from the stream winner's fruit to full enlightenment unless he patiently accepts this elusiveness of the Dharma." Then those gods thought, "What should one wish those to be like who are worthy to listen to the doctrine from the holy Subhuti. Subhuti read their thoughts and said, those who learn the doctrine from me, one should wish to be like an illusory magical creation. For they will neither hear my words nor experience the facts which they express. The gods, beings that are like a magical illusion, are they not just an illusion? Subhuti, like a magical illusion are those beings, like a dream. For not two different things are magical illusion and beings, are dreams and beings. All objective facts also are like a magical illusion, like a dream. The various classes of saints, from stream winner to Buddhahood, also are like a magical illusion, like a dream. The gods. A fully enlightened Buddha also, you say, is like a magical illusion, is like a dream. Buddhahood also, you say, is like a magical illusion, is like a dream. Subhuti, even Nirvana, I say, is like a magical illusion, is like a dream. How much more so anything else? The gods, even Nirvana, holy Subhuti, you say, is like an illusion, like a dream. Subhuti, even if perchance there could be anything more distinguished of that too, I would say that it is like an illusion, like a dream. For not two different things are illusion and nirvana, are dreams and nirvana. No one will grasp this perfect wisdom as here explained, for no Dharma at all has been indicated, lit up, or communicated. So, there will be no one who can grasp it.